Support for this public radio podcast comes from the History Channel, presenting 1968 with Tom Brokaw, Sunday, December 9th at 9 p.m., 8 Central, on the History Channel.
Hello, and welcome to Profiles. I'm Owen Johnson. It's a pleasure to visit with someone who has played an important role in journalism and in political and policy discussions in the United States. He's Nelson Strobridge Talbot, better known as Strobe Talbot, president of the Brookings Institution and former Time magazine correspondent and deputy secretary of state. Strobe, welcome to Profiles.
Thanks, Owen. Delighted to be here.
You have an interesting family background. You've been associated with Democratic administrations, but you have a, I guess one could say, an all-Republican background. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, I've only been associated with one Democratic administration. I was in the Clinton administration from day one to the end, and that came about in large measure because of a happy accident of my life, which is that I got to know the future president when we were in Oxford together many years ago in the late 60s. But I grew up in a family that was, I would say, moderate to liberal Republican. Those are words that you don't often hear joined together these days. But in any event, my mom and dad and many of my family were on that wing of the Republican Party. And the first, I guess, adult job I had connected with politics was working for Governor Bill Scranton of Pennsylvania when he was trying to stop Barry Goldwater from getting the Republican nomination in 1964. So I do have a sort of bipartisan background, as you say.
But you also had some sports background. If I am correct, your grandfather was an All-American in football, was he not?
He was indeed, and the captain of the Yale team. Yes, very much so.
Now, much of your career has been associated with things Russian. How did you develop an interest in Russian affairs?
It was a combination of literature and politics. As a high school student, actually at a prep school in Connecticut, Hotchkiss, I took a course in the Russian novel and translation, and I loved the material so much I wanted to read the material in the original. And so I took a course from the same wonderful teacher, Clinton Ely, who had taught the course in English and then was offering a course in the language, and I kind of got hooked on it. But I also mentioned politics. The early 1960s was, of course, very much the depths of the Cold War. It was during that period that the United States and the Soviet Union came to the brink of hot war, global thermonuclear war over Cuba. I was part of a generation that lived under that sort of cloud of danger. And there was a motto of in those days, know thine enemy. And so as I became more deeply immersed in the Russian language, I had support from the Defense Department while I was at college to go to the University of Michigan and brush up my Russian. And I've kind of been on that wicket ever since.
But isn't it still rather unusual for somebody in high school to take Russian?
Oh, and it wasn't that unusual in those days, because the Soviet Union was the single most important other country on the planet, because it was the single country that could destroy us. There was much more Russian taught in schools back in the 60s and I suspect into the 70s than now. Many schools that used to teach Russian now teach Chinese. Some are beginning to teach some of the languages of the greater Middle East and South Asia. Russian studies have fallen on hard times, I fear. And by the way, Indiana University, as I hardly need to tell you, is one of the real centers of excellence in teaching Russian. A lot of my colleagues over the years got their Russian education there. At least two of my finest teachers, Michael Holquist and Vadim Lipunov, have been on the faculty there at IU, and it's along with two or three other schools in the country, it's just first rank.
You originally were interested in being a doctor. Then you had this interest in Russian. When you went off to Yale, were you decided that it was going to be Russian, or did you still have a ways to go?
you've sure done your homework. My interest in medicine was partly because my uncle was a very distinguished doctor, but 2 weeks of organic chemistry in my freshman year cured me of that ambition, and I realized I was a humanist and not a scientist. But I'd already started studying Russian at prep school and was continuing that anyway at Yale, and so I just burrowed more deeply into it, basically. My intention pretty much from that point forward was to use it as a journalist. And journalism is really the only career I ever actually chose. The others just kind of fell on me out of the blue.
Where did the interest in journalism come from?
I always liked to write. I thought journalism was a terrific way to make a living wage and see the world and continue a liberal arts education. And I had an opportunity while I was in graduate school at Oxford to work for Time magazine that allowed me to get to Russia for the first time. And I spent some time covering Moscow back in those years. And I always loved the profession of journalism. And I still find that I think of myself in some ways as still a journalist. That is, I'm in the question asking business. I try to write as much as I can. And it served me well in the other jobs I've had since.
Were you involved with the Yale Daily News at
yes,
Yale?
I was the editor of it.
Now, it was in that situation, I think, when there was a famous, I guess a somewhat famous event when James Reston, Scotty Reston from the New York Times, came to Yale and wound up writing a column that mentioned you and a few of the words, if the Strobe Talbots at Yale, serious, idealistic, patriotic, progressive Republican types, did not support the war effort, the generals better start worrying. How did you happen to meet with Reston?
Well, because I was the editor of the paper. He was the guest of the Yale Daily News when he came up to Yale, and we spent some time talking, and a lot of the conversation was on the war in Vietnam, which I strongly opposed. That did not take a lot of political courage, I might add. It was very hard to find people of my generation, or certainly on the campuses, and the East Coast campuses in particular, but elsewhere in the country as well, who were not against the war by that time. The Vietnam War hung over all of us, both as a big political issue and also as a personal issue because of the draft.
You have taken some heat on the fact that you had a deferment from serving in Vietnam. Would you do it differently if you had a chance to do it over again?
I don't think so. I had a legitimate physical deferment, but I was sure glad that I have it. I did not want to serve in the military in a war that I thought was profoundly misguided. I would not say that I feel regret. What I feel regret about is that the country went through that extraordinarily polarizing trauma.
Your interest in Russia has been reflected not only in political writings but also in some study of Russian writers. And it strikes me a very interesting pair, one the subject of, an honors thesis at Yale, and the other the subject of a master's thesis at Oxford. Could you talk a bit about those two people?
Yes, they're names that don't mean a whole lot probably to your listenership, although with people like Vadim Lipunov perhaps listening in, and with IU as strong as it is Russian, they'll mean a lot. The first was a 19th century lyric poet by the name of Fyodor Tyutchev, who wrote, on the whole, fairly short poems, sometimes of a mystical bent, sometimes of a highly romantic bent, but beautiful use of language. And he's much beloved in Russia to this day, although, as always with poetry, very, very difficult to translate, and therefore not particularly well known outside of the Russian-speaking world. At Oxford, I did a thesis on a very different poet by the name of Vladimir Mayakovsky, who was a highly political figure, very active in the communist cause, kind of the poetic voice of the revolution in some ways, but also somebody of really great ingenuity and talent. And the thesis I wrote on him was on his lyric poems, and particularly his love poems, which are nowhere near as well known as his more political poems. And he died, it was suicide, with the onset of Stalinism for a variety of complicated reasons, not all of which we understand, but at least in part because he sensed that the revolution he had such high hopes for was turning very ugly.
Why did you write about poets when your interest was journalism and politics?
Well, I just I wrote a bit of poetry myself. I always found that poetry is the kind of quintessential use of any language, and it was a way of understanding the language better. And I love the material itself, and also because the poets that I studied were very much a part of the society and life of their times. By getting to know more about their lives and how they reacted to things, I learned a lot of history as well. So it was a kind of a window into or a portal into the study of Russia more generally. It's sometimes been said, Owen, and I think there's some truth to it, that people of my generation and perhaps earlier generations as well, who went on to spend a lot of their lives trying to understand the Soviet Union, tended to be more understanding, to see the admirable things about Russia than those, if they came in through the study of literature and culture, than if they came through the study of history and politics. Those who came in through the study of history and politics tended to be a bit more focused on the ugly side of Russian history and Russian life. But I was in the former category.
Now, you mentioned that it was during the time at Oxford that you made your first trip to Russia. What memories do you have of that first experience?
It was about a month. I went there by train, and it's a 48-hour train journey through the snows. So it was a good way to kind of get my mind into it. I took a lot of Russian books with me. I was on a train that had a Russian or a Soviet car. The other passengers were mostly Russian, so I got to spend some time with them. One thing that will always stay in my mind is the ease with which I was able to make friends once I got there. I had developed a couple of friendships on that very first trip that I kept up for many years afterwards. And then when I came back the following summer to spend the entire summer there, I developed some friendships that were really lifelong. There's a kind of intensity about friendship in Russia, in part because the life was then particularly, but still is to some degree, quite hard. There are lots of dangers. There's a lot of treachery. And as a result, people tend to invest more psychic energy in friendships that they can really trust. And there's kind of a culture of the kitchen table in Russia that people, you know, meet over hors d'oeuvres and drink and that kind of thing and talk through the night. And there's a kind of, the word again I'll use, intensity to it that makes it very satisfying in many ways.
Did you find—
Sometimes quite poignant.
Did you find anybody suspicious of a fluent Russian speaker from the United States? After all, this was after the Khrushchev period of openness. Brezhnev was clamping down.
Well, among other things, my Russian wasn't that fluent. I found that it wasn't I'd been studying Russian for, I guess, close to 7 years before I actually went there, and it really took the experience of being there and immersed in the language before I got comfortable with it to the degree that I would want. And by the way, a lot of rust has formed on it since then. But yes, there were certainly both people who were suspicious of me, assumed that I must be some kind of a spy, and there were certainly people who were themselves spies, that is to say Soviet spies, who approached me and tried to cultivate me in order, at a minimum, and to put it most benignly, figure out what I was up to, and perhaps they had designs beyond that. So that just came with the territory.
Now, there are two other aspects to your Oxford experience, and you've mentioned both of them already, but I think it would be interesting to go into more depth. Your roommate was one Bill Clinton. How did he come to be your roommate?
Well, not roommate, housemate.
Housemate, sorry.
That's okay. But it's funny, the roommate word is sort of it's one of those factoids that's just permanently embedded in my biography. But it was a house, and here's how it happened. We had gotten to be friends in September of 68 when we were part of a group of 31 American Rhodes Scholars who sailed on the USS United States to Southampton and start up our year at Oxford. We kind of bonded, but Bill Clinton bonded with a lot of people. I mean, you know, that was one of the – he had that genius about him then. In fact, I would say that Rhodes Scholars are not individually or collectively known for their excessive modesty. And if you had polled this group of 31 on the chances that one of them might be president of the United States someday, I think people would have said, yeah, pretty good chance of that. And if you asked them which one of the group had the best chance, a lot of people would have said Bill Clinton. So he had that kind of charisma back then. But we were in different colleges the first year. The second year, as the world knows, there was some question about whether he was going to be able to come back and or whether he was going to be drafted. And as the world knows, he was not drafted. And so he showed up at Oxford without a place to live. And he moved in with another member of our group for a while. And that fellow then had a girlfriend. And no more room for Bill Clinton. And I was sharing a house in North Oxford with a Rhodes Scholar from the state of Washington. And we had an extra room in our house. So we took him in, got along famously, and he went off to Yale Law School the year after that. I stayed on for a third year at Oxford, but we stayed close over the years that followed. And that's what led to the extraordinary opportunity to serve in his government.
I want to come back to that in a little bit. You also mentioned having started to work for Time magazine as a stringer. How did you get that job, since that was so important in advance of your long career with Time?
Yeah, and it also it led directly to my opportunity to translate the Khrushchev memoirs, too. The story there had to do with a loose institutional affiliation between the Rhodes Scholarship Program and Time magazine. The editor-in-chief of Time magazine, the successor to Henry Luce, was a wonderful guy named Hedley Donovan, who had been a Rhodes Scholar. And there was a practice of offering internships at Time to Rhodes Scholars between their first and second years at Oxford. I actually got a kind of jump start on that because I'd done some work for Time when I was at Yale. So I had a chance to intern for Time in its London bureau the summer between my last year at Yale and my first year at Oxford. And that in turn led to an internship in the Moscow Bureau between my first and second years at Oxford, which in turn, because of my knowledge of the language, led to my being asked to do the translation of Nikita Khrushchev's memoirs when they were smuggled out.
Why did they choose you, somebody in his early 20s? Yes, you'd studied Russian for some years. You had been to Russia. But why not one of the more established translators?
Well, it's a good question that certainly occurred to me. Part of the answer was that I had established a certain amount of trust on the part of the people who were supervising the project. The project was done in total secrecy. Second, I had the benefit of help from a native speaker, a fabulous friend of mine who was then in his 70s named Yasha Zaguskin, who was a neighbor of mine in Oxford. And I actually kind of kidnapped him and took him back to the U.S. to work on the translation with me. And we were under pressure to turn it out very, very fast in 6 months. So we worked harder than I've ever worked on anything in my life, just about. And with his native knowledge of the language and my knowledge of the language and us, our willingness to work, 18 hours a day, we were able to get it done. And then we did a second volume after Khrushchev's death in 1974.
How did those memoirs come out originally in the manuscript?
The first I saw of them, which was in the fall of 1969, I hope I've got that right. Jerry Schechter, who was the Time bureau chief I'd worked for in Moscow, called me up from London one day and said, bring your best Russian-English dictionary and come on into the Connaught Hotel. I got a little job for you. And so I did and was put up in a room, in kind of a garret up on the top floor of the Connaught Hotel, and given this massive stack of transcript, Khrushchev didn't write the memoirs. He dictated them into a tape recorder, and then they were transcribed. It subsequently emerged and we kept it a secret for a long time. We had to keep pretty much everything about it a secret as long as Khrushchev was alive. We couldn't even say that we had tape recordings. After he died, we not only revealed the tape recordings, we turned them over to Columbia University, where they're available for people to listen to today. We also did voice print analysis to make sure that they were 100% accurate. But the key figures in the getting the memoirs out were a couple of members of Khrushchev's family, particularly two of his sons-in-law and his son, Sergei, who now lives in the United States and is an American citizen and has been associated with Brown University. And then there was a mysterious character named Victor Louis, who was kind of the front person for the operation that had its roots in the family to get the material out.
And he was a London correspondent, wasn't he?
He was a kind of a character in the shadows, and there was a lot of controversy about him, and he was connected with some quite questionable activities, including smearing Alexander Solzhenitsyn and that kind of thing. There were always rumors that he was an officer in the KGB. I got to know him very well. My own sense, and I don't know the bottom line on him, is that he is far more complicated than his reputation at the time suggested, and much more of a combination of black and white.
Did you ever meet Khrushchev?
I never met Khrushchev. The closest I came was visiting his grave when, not too long after he died, it's in Novodevichy Cemetery in Moscow, and it's where sort of the second rank of Soviet luminaries tend to be buried. I did get to know Sergei Khrushchev and other members of the family quite well in the years that followed.
After those memoirs were translated, you established yourself for quite some time as the Time magazine specialist on Russia. You did most of your work in Moscow or outside of Russia?
Outside of Russia. I had hoped to do it inside of Russia. What happened, Owen, was this. I joined Time magazine when I finished my degree at Oxford. Time intended to send me to Russia as its correspondent, but first they sent me to Eastern Europe, and I spent 2 years there with my wife covering basically the Soviet satellite countries plus Yugoslavia. And then I was to move from there to Moscow. But during that period, we brought out the second volume of the Khrushchev memoirs, and the Kremlin had been pretty upset about the first volume, but they could simply dismiss it as a fabrication of the CIA. When the second volume came out, we kind of stuck our finger in their eye a little bit by saying, no, not a fabrication of the CIA. It's the real thing, and here are the tapes, and here are the voice prints. And that made them really furious. And essentially, they blackballed me. They made me persona non grata, and I was unable to get a visa even to go there for short trips, not to mention be posted there. So I essentially missed that opportunity, and I guess it was close to 5 years before I was able to go back to the Soviet Union. And by then, when I was, as it were, rehabilitated, they would have let me back. My wife and I had young children, and it just wasn't a good time in our lives to live in Moscow. So from that point forward, I made numerous trips every year, and I still try to go back with a lot of regularity. And when I was in the State Department, I was there all the time.
To what degree do you think the, as you termed it, rehabilitation came from the Soviet thinking that perhaps they could not afford to ignore you, that they had to make contacts?
Well, I'm not sure. I don't think I was that big a fish in their eyes, but there was and still is a quite well-known Soviet think tank head by the name of Georgi Arbatov, who ran something called the Institute for the USA in Canada. And anybody in the sound of our voice who knows Soviet history knows about Georgi Arbatov. And while he was very much a communist and very much part of the Soviet system, he was always kind of exploring what the limits were and operating on the edge and in a positive sense, in a very positive sense. And his institute was kind of an oasis where people who weren't quite acceptable politically in other settings would be allowed to work and that kind of thing. And I'm sure he had his own ties to the intelligence services. And I think he had quite a bit to do with saying, you know, this is – let's let bygones be bygones. You know, it's not Talbot's fault that Khrushchev got away with this and dictated his memoirs and they were published in the West. So let's let him back in. And they did.
Well, I'd like to continue this conversation in a moment. But as our listeners know, it's customary on this program for our guests to share some of their favorite music. What have you chosen and why?
I love Bach, and I particularly love Bach cantatas. And I most particularly love a CD of Bach sacred cantatas sung by Lorraine Hunt Lieberson, a fabulous mezzo-soprano who tragically died of breast cancer within the last year. And I find especially poignant Ich Haben Genug.
That was Ich Haben Genug.
Which I believe means I've had enough.
That was music chosen by our guest on Profiles today, Strobe Talbot, the president of the Brookings Institution. We left our conversation talking about your reestablishing contact in the Soviet Union. And not too long after that, this young man by the name of Mikhail Gorbachev came to power. What were your initial observations about Gorbachev?
Well, I would never claim, Owen, to have been prophetic enough to have seen how much he would do, how far he would go, and what the transforming consequences would be. But I would claim to have sensed pretty early on that this guy was different. And that he was kind of open to the world and less inclined to base Soviet rule on force and less inclined to rely on the big lie as his predecessors had done, and that he was truly a reformer. I heard things early on about him not wanting to get briefings from the sycophants and of the Central Committee, but to reach out to academic think tanks, including ones far outside of Moscow. He had a kind of dynamism about him, a self-confidence, and I think a degree of humanity that all came together to make Gorbachev Gorbachev. Now, just to be real clear, in trying to reform the Soviet Union, he was trying to save it. He had no intention of dismantling it or putting the system out of business. But it turned out, and this is one of the great ironies or paradoxes of his career, that one reason I think he will go down in history as, sort of one of Thomas Carlyle's great men of history is because he brought about something he didn't intend, which was the end of what Ronald Reagan famously called the evil empire.
That, of course, raises the question, to what degree was it Ronald Reagan's doing?
Well, Ronald Reagan's a good source on that. Ronald Reagan said in Moscow on his last trip there as president with Gorbachev by his side, when asked by American reporter, Ronald Reagan didn't deserve credit for the end of the Cold War, Ronald Reagan said, Not really, he said. This guy here does, pointing to Gorbachev. I think Ronald Reagan understood that much better than some of his hagiographers do. Now, I think Ronald Reagan and George Herbert Walker Bush deserve huge credit for the way they managed Gorbachev. They let Gorbachev feel that they, Reagan and Bush, would not exploit the weakness of the Soviet Union, that they would not take advantage of what he was trying to do to open the system up. And the kind of partnership that first Reagan and then Bush established with Gorbachev gave Gorbachev additional self-confidence and also additional political running room to keep moving the Soviet Union in the direction it was going, which turned out to be, of course, over the edge of the cliff in terms of the survival of the USSR. But it was a peaceful dissolution. And there, I think, the first President Bush deserves huge credit. He was like a very, very competent, calm, cool air traffic controller, kind of guiding Gorbachev in for a something other than a crash landing. And that's one of the things I think that the first President Bush will always be remembered for and will be greatly appreciated by future historians for doing. And Gorbachev saw that too.
The ironic thing, of course, is that Gorbachev is no longer loved in his homeland. He's much more popular outside of the country.
Well, that's been true for a long time, and that was true at the end of his own period. I mean, you remember there in the summer of 1991, the hardliners, his own comrades in the leadership, staged a coup against him. And no, it's absolutely true. He was much despised. In fact, I would say not until Yeltsin fell so out of favor with his own people was there anybody as unpopular in Russia as Gorbachev. Because there was a lot of nostalgia, and still is, in case we hadn't all been reminded of this recently, there still is a lot of nostalgia for the power, the raw power and might that came with being a superpower in the Soviet Union. I mean, the Soviet Union lost almost half of its territory, not to mention its defining ideology and its flag and all that kind of stuff, when it broke up into 15 different countries.
Shortly after the end of the Soviet Union came the election of Bill Clinton as president, and not too long after that, you crossed the line from being a journalist to a policymaker. Many journalists would have trouble with that kind of step. What was your feeling at the time?
Well, I suppose at some level, naked terror. I found it quite daunting, frankly, all of a sudden to be not just an official but at a reasonably high level in the government. I was not, in the first year, by the way, Deputy Secretary of State. I was put in charge by Secretary Warren Christopher of a newly created bureau to manage relations with all of the former Soviet republics except for the three Baltic states, which were part of the European Bureau. It was a little scary, but it didn't last. And it wasn't scary for that long. I mean, there were a couple. I remember at the very beginning, I felt like a character in a Chevy Chase movie, you know, about an out-of-body experience. You know, I would wake up in the morning, and why was there this limousine in front of the house? And, oh, my God, it's going to take me to the State Department. I'm going to be sitting at the end of a table and expected to conduct a meeting on how to make foreign policy. But I got over that pretty quickly. And one reason I got over it is, first of all, I realized very soon that there was nothing magic about being on the inside of those closed doors that I looked through the peephole on the keyhole on all those years. They were just folks, you know, hardworking, overworked, underpaid people working under extraordinarily difficult circumstances on some of the toughest problems there are. And they were doing their best, and it was exhausting, and they didn't always succeed. And you know, they lost their energy level sometime, and they lost their temper sometimes, and it was tough on their families. So I developed a real empathy with them and then tried to do the best job I could. But the other thing is, there's no secret manual that you get when you sign papers going in saying, okay, you're now entitled to see all of the nation's most sensitively attained and strictly guarded secrets, that's great. You do get to see that stuff, but you don't get a manual, a secret manual that says, here's how you run the world. That you have to make up as you go along, and that's hard. But the other thing is that the skill set that I had developed as a journalist for over 20 years came in pretty handy in some ways, because being a journalist or a reporter really comes down to the following things: figuring out what's going on, figuring out what matters in what's going on, then being able to explain it to others. And if you are a commentator or a columnist, as I was, also having opinions on what policy should be. So all of that I found kind of transferred from one profession to the one that all of a sudden I had in government.
But some people would say that journalists are not used to working in a bureaucracy and would feel very constrained.
Well, you know, the bureaucracy, of course, the State Department's a bureaucracy and the government's a bureaucracy, but I came quickly to regard it as not necessarily a pejorative word. And large organizations are made up of people. And if you've got the right people in the right slots and they have decent working relationships, you can have genuine teamwork in a large bureaucracy. And I certainly benefited from that. And I was very fortunate to be part of an administration unlike ones that came before, which I had written books about, where there were just vicious interagency wars, you know, Cy Vance versus Big Brzezinski and Henry Kissinger battling it out with Bill Rogers. And almost every previous administration had these kind of battle royals going on. And there really wasn't much of that in the Clinton administration. I'd like to think it was partly because of the people Clinton picked, but it was also kind of the atmosphere that he created. He was very much a team builder, very open to debate, you know. None of the problems that we've seen with our current president, who's got such certitude and such an unwillingness to listen to challenging views from inside or outside. Clinton, sometimes it seemed almost to a fault, wanted to hear people criticize his policy so he could then test the proposition. Well, how do we defend the policy against that charge? What's the counter to that argument that so-and-so is making? So I did not feel myself to be burdened by working within a bureaucracy. And I had a lot of responsibility for the operational side of the State Department, because that's one of the things that being Deputy Secretary of State means. You take that burden as much as possible off the Secretary.
Did you find it unusual to have to deal with the press in an official position?
A little weird, particularly at the beginning, since these were all former colleagues. You know, we'd been bouncing around the world in the back of the plane, in the press section of these planes, and now all of a sudden I was in the front of the plane. And I was speaking to them, and I knew all their tricks too, which I think I quickly developed a reputation for being not the best source, because I knew the games that they were playing and how to be sure that I stuck with what I ought to be saying in terms of advancing policy. But I maintained good relations with most of my colleagues in the press. I was very, very careful never to deceive them. I would not tell them everything they wanted to know, but I would tell them enough to allow them to do their stories. I think the fact that I knew what they needed to write a good story and still give them what would be helpful to what we were trying to accomplish was an asset.
Now, Strobe, I'd like to kind of search out your views on a couple of world areas. One of them, of course, is the one that you've been associated with the longest, although not the only one, and that's Russia. What is your evaluation of Vladimir Putin?
Vladimir Putin is a modern 21st century reincarnation of a historic Russian type, which is, there's a word in Russian I'm going to use, vozhd, the leader, the autocrat, the big boss. If you want, Owen, we can talk about it in more detail. There's obviously a lot more to it than that. But he essentially believes that the power of the Russian state and preserving that power depends largely on investing that power in one man. And he believes in top-down, center-outward control. And we're seeing that in spades with every passing week. And now we see him, of course, going through an elaborate dance to try to perpetuate his version of how to run Russia after he steps down this next year after the elections. And, of course, the latest evidence is that he may do that, and I stress may because I think we could this thing could go through six different variants before we see what the actual outcome is. He may emerge as prime minister under a president who is, in fact, quite weak and malleable. So Russia could go from being a system with an extremely strong president to whom the prime minister is totally subordinate to just the opposite.
Many Russians seem to think that that's a good idea.
Yes, and that is part of the reality, and I would say part of the problem. Putin's popularity is up in the 80 percentile, and you know you have to discount that somewhat because Russia now, unfortunately, has in the air kind of the smell of fear. So when people answer poll questions, they're not exactly sure how much their anonymity will be protected and so forth and so on. But I don't think there's any doubt that he is very popular. And the reasons why he's popular are the following. First of all, he's not Boris Yeltsin. And Boris Yeltsin, particularly towards the end of his presidency, was very unpopular, largely because he was seen as somebody who had knocked down the old system but had not put a workable system in its place. There was a lot of hardship under him, and there was a lot of political uproar and instability. And that is not the case under Putin. Things have smoothed out. And because of the fabulous oil wealth that they have and natural gas and other stuff that can be dug or pumped out of the ground, Russia is rolling in money. And while a lot of that money has ended up in extremely corrupt hands, a lot of it has also gone into raising the living standards, raising the per capita GDP, and that kind of thing. But the last factor I'd mention goes back to your point. There are a lot of exceptions to this, but many, many Russians want a strong leader. And boy, has Putin given them that.
How well do you think the Bush administration has handled foreign policy toward Russia?
Recently, not bad. But for quite a number of years, they simply weren't paying attention. And that goes back to when President Bush came into office. You know, Owen, every one of his predecessors, going back certainly to Harry Truman, I guess you could say FDR too, although FDR had the war to think about, every one of Bush's predecessors in modern times asked, what is the most important strategic relationship in the world? Would have said the U.S.-Soviet relationship. And then when you got into the post-Soviet period, first Bush Sr. and then Clinton, both of them would have put managing the relationship with Russia right up at the top. I don't think that the Russia issue figured on the top 10 list of strategic issues that the Bush administration was concerned about. Now, that was partly because of 9/11. It was partly because of terrorism. It was partly because of Iraq and so forth and so on. But they just basically took their eye off the ball. And insofar as they had their eye on the ball, they were looking at it in the wrong way. President Bush, you may recall, originally came into office saying he was going to give kind of, you know, the cold shoulder treatment to Putin. Then he had a meeting with him and looked into his eyes and saw his soul. Then 9/11 happened. Putin was the first foreign leader to call Bush within an hour after the first plane hit the first of the World Trade Towers, offered him every possible help. Bush immediately saw Putin as an ally in the war on terror and stuck with that image of Putin long after it became evident that what Putin was really looking for was American indulgence of the Russian crackdown in Chechnya on the grounds that the Chechens were all terrorists, which of course they're not. So only in the last year or two or a couple of years, I think partly because Condoleezza Rice, who really knows Russia very, very well, that's how I first got to know her 20 years ago, she began to see that there was a major Russia issue or major Putin issue, and but it's kind of too late now, frankly. Like a lot of countries and leaders around the world, Russia and Putin are just sort of biding their time with this administration and waiting for the next one.
What's your evaluation about the issue of balancing Eastern Europe versus Russia? Steve Cohen wrote in The Nation several months ago condemning the U.S. for being too supportive of what we used to call Eastern Europe and not paying enough attention to Russia. Since you've been a correspondent in both those areas, how do you balance those?
Well, not to pick a fight with Steve Cohen, who I have a lot of respect for as a historian, but much more respect for him as a historian than as a commentator on current events, I just think he's wrong. And this has been a running polite argument between Steve and me for a very long time. I think that Central and Eastern Europe are immensely important. They also represent a group of countries that have gotten one of the great raw deals from history of all time. You know, they, on the whole, those people very, very much want and deserve to be part of the West. And when I say the West, I don't mean so much the geographical West as the ideological West. And we, the United States, quite rightly, going back to the Clinton administration, and by the way, to the first Bush administration, have been making all kinds of efforts to bring them in, and we should continue to look out for them, particularly now that Russia is throwing its weight around in its own neighborhood. Most especially, of course, towards other former republics of the USSR, and here I'm thinking particularly of Georgia and Armenia, but also the countries of Central Europe. So I just think keeping a bright light of attention and support on Central and Eastern Europe is not only important, but it should not be inherently at odds with developing a good relationship with Russia. Because insofar as Russia has hegemonistic or aggressive intentions towards Central and Eastern Europe, we shouldn't have good relations with them on that issue. We're going to have to be selective about those areas where we can cooperate with Russia and those areas where we're going to have to make very clear that we have our differences. And if there are third parties involved, like the Central and East Europeans, we're going to have our own relationship with those folks. And we're not going to defer to Russia in developing those relations, which is why I think one of the great accomplishments of the Clinton administration was enlarging NATO to bring in first former satellites of Russia and then former republics of Russia. It was important in its own right, and it also served as an inducement for the European Union to do the same thing.
Some people listening to this discussion, Strobe, will say that you sound very much like somebody very interested in policy, and I notice that the blogs and the rumor mills around Washington are saying if Hillary Clinton, who is a friend of your wife's as well, I think she's been an advisor to her, if she's elected president, you might be a strong candidate for Secretary of State. Would you be interested?
Well, sure, I'd be interested. But much more pertinent is what do I think about the rumor mongering that's going on. I find it amusing, entertaining, and of virtually no substantive plausibility. Among other things, Senator Clinton, to use a phrase that her husband often used, is focused like a laser on getting the Democratic nomination. If she gets the Democratic nomination, she's going to focus like a laser on winning the presidency, and she is not going to waste time or create distractions by encouraging speculation about who's going to get what job in her administration. Moreover, Owen, you know, I think that there is a huge pool of talent out there for every important job. And I think that quite properly, one factor that will weigh with her as she puts together her team is going to be that it be an administration that bears her own stamp and that is clearly hers and that is not sort of recycled from the previous Clinton administration, of which I was a part. So long and short, I don't pay much attention to that stuff. Plus, I've got a terrific job here at the Brookings Institution.
Unfortunately, we've run out of time for today's conversation. Our guest has been Strobe Talbott, journalist, policymaker, and the president of the Brookings Institution. Strobe, thanks for visiting.
I really appreciate it, Owen.
And to our listeners, we're pleased you joined us. For WFIU, I'm Owen Johnson.
The program you just heard was recorded in October of 2007. The studio engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. More information about Profiles, including archives of past shows, can be found on our website at wfiu.org. Profiles is a production of WFIU and comes from the studios at Indiana University. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. Please join us again for the next edition of Profiles. For WFIU, thanks for listening.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.